Let's go.
In episode 2, we transition to we are now on the run. We're riding all day into the night, and we arrive at Taran Ferry. So Taran Ferry is obviously a place with a ferry. There is a big river that we need to cross. I just love this little scene because it again reinforces this idea of how normal everyday people perceive the Aes Sedai. Moraine basically rolls up and is like, we need to cross the fucking river. And she flashes the ring again. And the guy says, well, you know, obviously you're not someone who is used to saying no, or someone saying no to you. And she's like, yeah, you're fucking right. So homeboy Master Hightower is his name. Gets the ferry ready to go. Our whole squad hops on with their horses right almost in the nick of time, essentially, because then we see as we're crossing the river, the whole Trolloc army is right on their heels. They get to the point and stop. And our man, Master Hightower, is in for quite the night. Bro. He did not know what he was getting into when he woke up to our squad rolling up on him.
But dude, just tell me what you guys thought of the first. This is the first time we actually get the Fade or the Half-Man or the Eyeless, all synonyms. I think the show's going to lean into the Eyeless idea, so sticking with the Eyeless. When the Eyeless, it kind of feels like Hardhome from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Exactly like that, right? Like the Eyeless knows right now you guys are out of reach, but I'm coming for you motherfuckers. And just does the whole fucking screech, which gave me chills when it happened, but... Just tell me, that was your first experience of seeing what we're working with. This is like the peg up from the Trolloc foot soldiers. These are like the intermediate generals of the Dark Army. And this is your first experience. What do you guys think?
I think the fact that you could tell that they have some form of intelligence makes them way scarier.
Yeah.
And already on paper, if you're just looking at it and how mysterious it is with the cloak and versus how it is standing next to the Trollocs, the mystery behind it just makes it that much more scary. And I absolutely love the design. I think it's perfect. I think it's absolutely terrifying. And anyone in their right mind would want to fuck off themselves the moment they run in front of one of these things.
You like that skull on the horse too?
Oh my God. The horse was the best part of it. It looks so badass. So,
yeah, it makes me think, is the horse like the regular horse with the mask on?
Maybe
or
the
like
horse is the dark
one. Dead horse?
No, it's the dark one.
The horse is the dark one. Yeah.
That is very interesting you say that. We will be talking about that comment.
Are you serious?
I swear to God, for years to come.
Oh my God. So amazing.
Put a pen in and put it on the board.
Put it on the board. We need a literal board in one. This room.
Two things. One, the eyelashes or the fades, whatever you want to call it, mouth. It was like a sea monster's mouth.
Wasn't it like the dune?
Actually,
mouth?
I was just gonna. That's what like I rose worm. My hand for.
I never thought about that till right now, too. Yeah. I didn't even have
literally
that
the dune worm. Yep.
Second off, I was a little annoyed that our heroes, Moraine Land and High Master, whatever, Dickwad, was on the barge and like a little bit. We also learned, you know. Trollocs are their one fear is deep water, so that's why they're not jumping in after them. But they're on the barge like halfway across the river. Cut the rope, dude.
See, my thinking behind that though is that I think it's more of they a momentum based. Like you're using it to pull yourself across, sure, but once you get going, you're gonna go. It's more about the way you use it to come back. Like you need it to kind of like direct the ship, but once the ship's moving, it's moving. Like I don't think it's necessary. I don't know though. I don't know how it works.
You're upset that they didn't do it halfway or they didn't do it at all.
That the Trollocs didn't cut it right when they were crossing.
Oh, the Trollocs.
Yes.
Yeah, well, they're too dumb for that.
So that was
That's what I also figured.
That was my assumption of why.
Oh, yeah.
Is because they're straight up animals.
Dude, they're way too dumb.
Like, you know, and the attack on the Two Rivers town, like they were just straight up eating dead bodies when people were running by them because they're straight up animals. Like, they're stupid.
If that's a million peaches and you get on that boat, your cat and they're you get on that boat and you're crossing, you think Peaches is gonna be like, come back, cut the rope?
Well, I don't know.
Exactly.
I will say though, I don't know how much they're gonna lean into it into the show, but there is culture to the Trollocs. There's different clans, they have a little bit of a culture, but they don't, I don't think, have enough intelligence to kind of make that type of maneuver.
That's why when you told me that they speak in the books,
it happens one time. I will say,
okay, yeah.
It was
What's
definitely
his name?
Narg.
Narg.
It was definitely like a first bookism.
It's the only time it ever happened.
It was a first bookism of like, oh, okay. They did it. And then he was kind of like,
maybe not.
That blows my mind. That's not something I do.
That makes me happy because when you said they speak, I was like, maybe they're smarter than I think.
No.
But yeah. I'm going to lean into their dumb animals.
No,
that's why Narg is iconic.
Yes.
Okay.
The Trollocs are essentially just ruled by fear and instinct. So the only reason why they are just like would march throughout the night and all the shit is because the Fade, they're afraid of the Fade or the Eyeless. And I just, Dave, I want to roll back a little bit to the comment that you made where, like, if you looked at this thing, you would off yourself. There is a common phrase that's used in the books is that the look of an Eyeless is fear. Borderline paralyzing when you come face to face with these
Slender
things.
Slender Man thing. It's but with a mouth.
Yeah, honestly.
Slender Man is terrifying. So, yes.
So to finish this scene, Moraine, actually, when they get to the other side, she has Paul's idea where she wants to destroy the ferry, the barge. So she creates a whirlpool and Master Hightower,
dumbass,
in his, I guess, honorable line of thinking to save his son, just jumps into the water. And I would go as far as to say kills himself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She specifically says
Moraine would agree with that statement. And she didn't kill him. I mean, he literally willingly jumped in this world.
But I will also say this shows you a little bit that the power, it's so overwhelming. It could sometimes be sloppy. Right. Like, it's not like super controlled. She can't be like, all right, whirlpool done. You know, it's not like Marvel. Like, it's a little bit more naturistic. It's a beast that not everybody truly understands. And yeah, sometimes it's overwhelming.
Follow up question. The way the Trollocs catch up to them eventually, they obviously don't touch on it. Do we just assume they went around?
Yeah,
they built a bridge.
They went the long way, baby. They went up and around.
Because I thought the whole thing was like, yeah, once we get to the river and cross, we'll be safe. But you
ever see the Brad Pitt zombie movie World War Z?
Yeah.
When it's basically just throw a bunch of bodies into the water. Eventually enough will get across. Maybe I don't.
It's more of a function that's like a wide part of the river,
okay,
and they just travel up river to cross.
Yeah, okay. I can do.
It wasn't like a big river.
That was the thing. I didn't know it was like the river because they say like once we get there we'll be safe. I didn't know if it was like notoriously like big.
We lose Master Hightower very quickly. Is that Hightower does say the White Cloaks are right about you guys to Moraine. So again, we're just really hammering home this idea that the common folk don't really fuck with the Aes Sedai.
And I think that was the whole purpose of that scene.
Oh, yeah.
No matter how stupid it was that he just randomly jumped in, it was just to emphasize the fact that like people can view them terribly.
And our squad of four, our Edmondsfield
and
four at this point, are kind of like, oh, shit. You know, she is willing to do whatever it takes to get this mission done.
All right. So then we start showing some cool, in my opinion, one of the cooler uses of the power is you get a quick glimpse of Moraine actually taking away the fatigue of some of the horses. Like, she has that ability, and that's cool to know. But this is where we start having...
I think you should actually elaborate like just a little bit more on that, just because my first and second watch through, even third watch through, I didn't really catch
that. It's super subtle. It's way more explicit in the book. And it's actually important because they're always traveling, and Moraine's always taking away the Emmonsfield's force fatigue. Like, but we already know from future episode, maybe even later in this episode, Aes Sedai can't use the power on themselves. So they can't heal themselves. They can't take their own fatigue away. So you just said to get a quick glimpse. It's like a book shout out a little bit when she's she's waking the horse up a little bit more.
I didn't catch it. Yeah. The wisp was smoke. I want to keep calling it that, even though it's not actual smoke, but like you see it on the horse's face. And then all of a sudden from it being crouched, it just jumps up and it's ready to go.
There's something that happens in the book with this scene that's very similar that we won't be able to talk about until the end of this season. But we will reference this scene again, and it'll be fun to talk about it then and kind of see everyone's reaction to that.
You see a little of the kids gossiping. They start talking about the dragon and like this whole idea of the prophecy. Rand says specifically, they say that the last dragon broke the world, but the next one will save it. Mm-hmm. And you agree, right, Dave?
Yeah, there's no way that's changing.
But it's just important to know that they know the rumors. They know the prophecy now, and like they're aware of what the DR is. And then I think the next important thing that happens really is the Moraine later that night, the Moraine and the Egwene conversation. And to me, this was amazing to me because they start dropping some names that you don't have to worry about now. Arthur Hawkwing, like this is just some good deep history named people. But they say Arthur Hawkwing's three laws that bound all Aes Sedai.
The three oaths.
And actually, I only have the wording of two of them. So if you actually have all three, because what Moraine is asking Egwene, who has heard of the three oaths, and they
are word for word.
Okay,
right,
so let's
here.
Hear him. Let's hear him.
One, to speak no word that is not true. Two, to make no weapon with which one man may kill another. Three, never to use one power as a weapon except against dark friends or shadow spawn, or in the last extreme defense of her life, the life of her warder, or another Aes Sedai.
Yeah.
Essentially breaking it down, saying that you can only defend yourself, your warder, and another Aes Sedai. That's it. That's the only time you can use it.
And so the only thing, before I let you guys jump in here, these laws are so, they cannot be broken. Meaning like Meereen and any of the Aes Sedai sisters, it's not that they won't tell a lie because it's like their quote unquote like religion or belief or anything like that. They physically cannot speak a word that is not true. So just know that these limitations are in their blood. It's in their DNA now.
And it's funny how you're calling them limitations, because now that you say that word and I'm looking at all of my notes and everything, I'm kind of more now on the page that Egwene is not going to be the Dragon Reborn. Like, I think the Dragon Reborn wouldn't have these limitations per se. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think the Dragon Reborn's not going to have like be able to use their power only to save themselves, the warder, or an Aes Sedai. So if she chose, if Egwene chooses to go this route, there's no way she's the Dragon Reborn. That's my thought process.
We mentioned the women's circle scene with Egwene, and Paul and Luke, you had both said that scene kind of didn't really serve so much of a purpose, or that it was kind of whatever, it didn't really need to be there. Or at the very least, it was kind of a question. This is where it comes back into play. Because Moraine teaches Egwene how to touch the power using the analogy of surrendering yourself to the river.
Oh, that's cool.
So she learns that essentially. She is it's way easier for her to get it quick because she had that experience.
I thought that was like a whole Aes Sedai. The water was an analogy that everybody uses. So
it is that. There's a way that they talk about it, how opening yourself up to the power for women. A lot of women use similar tricks like that, but that was the purpose of the callback.
That's like for the easiest way for her to understand.
Yeah.
Personally, she like it clicks for her a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. Okay. I like that. That makes a lot more sense. And I'm very glad that you said that. My other question, you guys said that like an Aes Sedai can't lie. They like physically can't lie.
So they cannot speak a word that is not true.
Okay. So the third oath saying they can never use one power to kill unless against, what was it? Against a dark fiend?
You have to use against a dark fiend or a shadow spawn.
No. Dark friend.
Except against dark friends or shadow spawn, or in the last extreme defense of her life and the life of her friends.
And let's quickly clarify on that verbiage. Shadow spawn are non-human part of the army, like of the dark one side. So that's Trollocs and Fades.
That was my big question.
And dark friends are humans that are on the dark one side.
Because that was my big question, was like, Meereen's killing a lot right now. And it's definitely not just to save her or a warder or, you know, another Aes Sedai. So the fact that they are able to kill dark friends.
Everything that she has killed using the power on purpose up until this point has been a Trolloc. So the Master Hightower death was not directly because she of says her.
Yeah. Sorry, I got to do agree. It. We got to make the anime comparison. Kurapika from Hunter x Hunter can only use his power against the Phantom Troop, and here we are.
Yes, it's exactly like that.
Exactly. Yep.
And there are loopholes, of course. Not loopholes, but there are workarounds, as always. Yes. Like you can tell from the lying rule.
Mm-hmm. We also got the sweet, you know, you say you listen to the wind. No. The wind listens to you.
Yep. Because channeling using the one power is essentially capturing the power of nature almost. Mm-hmm. So a very quick little thing that we do see in this scene is that Rand does see this interaction happen. So that is slightly important for some things that happened a little bit later in this episode. But Rand kind of sees Meereen in his eyes, you know, sinking her fingers a little bit into his girl, Egwene.
Kind of how Tam views it.
Yes, exactly. She is pulling the strings, essentially. And also, we do learn in this little collection of scenes that Perrin is wounded. Perrin has been hurt from the Trolloc attack. He has some claw marks on his leg. He obviously is not telling anyone.
Pissing me off.
Always verbally pissed off throughout the whole back
end. I just don't understand why. Like, we already saw Meereen can use her powers to heal the Trolloc poison and heal wounds. She can heal other people besides not herself. But, like, is he not saying it because he doesn't want to talk about how it's a wound, about when he actually killed Layla? Like, I just don't get it, and I have hope that they're gonna explain it, and if they don't, I'm going to be pissed.
It's funny that your tone makes me think that you're not too happy with the storyline. Meanwhile, in my notes, I said, this is the most interesting storyline to me so far is his connection with the wolves.
This is an amazing scene, and a very important scene we get next is actually a dream scene. Rand falls asleep, and I just love how in the beginning of it, he wakes up and you just think he's waking up in the middle of the night. But I think the key thing here is that it's silent. There's no noise. You're not hearing nature. The leaves aren't ruffling. So you kind of can feel something's a little wrong. And then our boy just proceeds to cough up a bat.
Dead bat.
Which I'm just a little curious of what you guys were thinking when he coughed up the fucking bat.
I was thinking, this isn't what Ozzy Osbourne would do. Ozzy Osbourne would eat the head off that bat and fucking swallow. No.
They literally reverse the footage.
Yeah, reverse the Ozzy footage, and it's this Ozzy at his concert now. But honestly, creepy ass scene. Paul called it out in his first watch. So he was like, this has got to be a dream. But it wasn't really a dream, but creepy as fuck. Like, you see him pull that wing out first, and then it's the body. It's like, this nasty.
And it's like, yeah, why bats? Like, why?
Yeah,
bats
why bats
is my,
too?
Is my big question. And like, they did say earlier, they said, oh, I heard rumors like the Dragon Reborn, like, will actually have wings and shit like that. And I was like, you know, bats have wings. Bats have, I was like, wings. Is there a connection?
It's like they coughed up like a wolf skull. Maybe that would have made some sense. But a bat that's like coming out of left field at this point.
You
time.
Are grinding out connections in your head right now. It's bro. So funny.
I got way more.
Paul's yeah. great at that.
Yeah, but Paul is really good at this.
So a very important part of this scene also is that when Rand actually wakes up,
the bat.
Is there are bats everywhere.
Yes.
And
it's not just one.
Yeah. There's
it's
a fuck ton.
Crazy.
And everyone else has had the dream as well. Rather, everyone from Evans Field has had the dream.
And this is a little anecdote when we were watching it, because I had my roommates trying to guess who the dragon was the whole time, right? So when this first dream starts happening, they're all like, oh, it's Rand. He's having the dream. And you see the dark one
Paul
for a second,
said it too,
right?
Or Alki, one of them said it too. They're yeah, like, yeah. When he's watching, like, I said the same yeah. shit.
Because you, for a second, you see the dark one, like you see his eyes, right? Like you see
eyes
fire,
like Ember.
Eyes. And then, so as soon as Rand wakes up and he walks over and he's talking to Moraine and tells
see,
what we said,
you, see three
you
other
find
bats.
Out all of the others are having this. So right away, like all my roommates were like, oh my God, it's Rand. He's the dragon. And then they're like, he had the dream. And then everyone else says, they're like, okay, out the window, it's back to Perrin.
Yeah, back to everyone being on the table.
It's very interesting though, because, you know, we see Rand's dream and then we hear Matt talk about his dream and his dream. All the bats, there's multiple bats and their necks snapped in midair. He didn't pull it out from his throat. So it's like, okay, we got those two. I'm wondering what the other two dreams were. And, you know, if each dream means something else, like they're on a different path or something. I will say at the end of episode one, we have Moraine saying she's telling the story about the Aes Sedai with the eye so white that was born. And then she also goes on to say that the dark one's whispers are like already within us. And I was like, yo, is this one of the dark one's whispers? Is this how he's like getting connected?
That is a wonderful catch that you caught that line. That line will be something else that we'll be talking about in a couple of years as well.
So. Why are you good at this?
So they have the dream conversation. Moraine is she's very vocal about the idea that dreams have powers, right? So she's like concerned. She's like, what did you see? What happened in all your guys' dreams? And then she says, before she walks away, if this shit happens again, you tell me right away. And then that sparks Rand freaking out, right? He blows up for a second, and I'll get back to that in 1 second. But then she storms off. She's about to storm off, and Rand's like, all right, well, I'm going to leave then. And Moraine says, well, you know what? I don't have time for you. Go ahead and leave. She leaves. And then that's when Rand and Egwene have the next confrontation that they haven't had in a minute, where Rand's going to pull the wisdom card about how Egwene already gave up on the idea of their relationship being something. And like, they have that whole back and forth. Egwene says, you're basically being a dick. Moraine has saved our lives multiple times. There's no fucking way she's as bad as the Trollocs that are trying to kill us.
And yeah. Rand's also like, she's playing favorites. Like, you and her clearly yes. have a connection.
So that's what I'll take it back and I'll pass it over to you, Paul. I am super passionate about this scene and I actually really, really love it in hindsight, but just tell me, are you team Egwene? Are you team Rand? Do you think Rand has a point or do you think Rand's being irrational? Just tell me what you think about that blow up. Cause that scene is powerful for me.
You vocalized a little bit of your thoughts about this scene because we have the four of them just like literally verbalizing their thoughts and you can go to each of them and be like, yo, they have a point. Rand has a point. He's like, yo, you're a random person. You just pulled us away from our village. You didn't tell us anything. You barely tell us where you're going. We're just supposed to trust you. At the same time, Egwene is like, bro, you saw the Trolloc. You want to go back to them? They were eating your fucking friend from the inside out. And then, you know, they go to Matt, and Matt is saying, if I had to choose, I would choose following the woman that shoots fireballs, because I don't want...
So, my lady does shoot fireballs, or something like that.
So, like, they all make good points. It makes good points. And, like, they're kind of thinking, like, the same thing we're thinking. Yo, what the fuck's going on? Who is this person?
So, just initial take, which Team Rand or Team Egwene on that conversation?
I can't be both.
I mean,
I was literally dead 50-50. The only reason I side with Egwene is literally because I'm going to follow the person who has the plant, not even can just shoot fireballs, but at least has a plan for us. We leave her. Okay, what's our plan? You have literally jack shit. You have to go to a random town, cut some fucking wood.
Yeah.
Sleep in a bunk. Like, that's not happening. Like, you're going to follow the one that has a plan to me.
He has a sword that he pretty much doesn't know how to use. And that's it.
Epic sword, though.
It's a great sword. It's a great sword.
That was good as Dave's sword right there.
I got two good swords right here.
Is one of them your penis?
How was you going to say? Three.
Two and a half.
So after our little dust up with Egwene and Rand, we get back on the road. So as we're on the road, we run into a new faction, Luke's favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Not his favorite faction, but the fact that we get a new faction.
Thank you for clarifying.
Because nobody
might be my favorite faction.
Get the fuck out of here. Nobody.
No, Dave actually said that.
Okay. Yeah. Apparently, Dave fucks with the White Cloaks. So actually, this is not the first time we've seen the White Cloaks in this episode. The cold open of episode 2 that we glossed over just so things were a little bit more consistent in us talking about the Edmondsfield 4 and Moraine and Lan is we don't get his name at the moment, but his name is Aemon Valda. So Valda, this is a crazy start to an episode because we've just seen Moraine basically protect the entire village and put her life on the line. And now we transition to a White Cloak man who is burning an Aes Sedai at the stake.
Complete parallel to actually the first opening we got in episode 1. Parallel where we see the Aes Sedai chasing the man and almost essentially burning him or killing him rather. And the Aes Sedai aren't all powerful as we thought they were in that cold opening of episode 1.
Yeah, that actually, I didn't think about it until you mentioned that she's being burned at the stake. What do these White Cloaks do? How are they so strong that they can capture an Aes Sedai?
That's what I'm excited for, too, because we don't get it in these three episodes. No. The power of Aemon Valda. We don't know what he's capable of. Like,
yeah. I just have him as the captain.
So I think a little insight into that question is in this interaction we get when we meet back up with him in the forest. We know with the three oaths that Moraine can't use the one power willy-nilly.
Mm-hmm.
So, she can't just lash out with the power against the White Cloaks.
It's one of the okay.
Yeah, they are restrained in that sense that they can't just see a White Cloak and fuck them up. Like, they need to feel the threat against their life to do
so. They basically, the White Cloaks would have one, let's go, this is all for all the marbles moment. Like, let's capture them.
Yeah,
they're weak.
There's also a common like phrase that's used in the books, an arrow can just kill an Aes Sedai from behind. You just shoot.
Kind of does. Hits her. That was a cool moment, at least for me, because it showed they're not indestructible gods, right? Shit can happen.
Yeah, you can knock them out. You can knock them unconscious. You can drug them. There's a lot of different ways. And then he proceeds to cut off her hands.
Yes.
Which is a big thing because we know how much Moraine uses her hands when she uses the power.
Yes.
So all of that is kind of combining to be that this guy does not fuck around.
This was the confirmation for me that the person who's trying to take down an Aes Sedai cut off their hands, aka they need their hands to use their power.
Yeah.
So this was the confirmation of that.
Now, is it because they need their hands, or is it because it's the ring that's the power, or is it the hand motions like the magicians? Like, what is
it? I'm going to bring out a quote from Hunter x Hunter. Netero, when he's fighting the King Ant, says he's using two hands to pray the entire fight. The king cuts his arm, thinks he has him in checkmate. He's like, you don't need two hands. You can pray with one hand. It's like the same thing. It's like you could still use magic with one hand.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think it's the ring because they have shown scenes where they use the opposite ring hand to channel magic.
Yeah. So, and I will say that I think it's too early in the series to be used in words like confirmation on something like this.
Okay. Or that's a good point. That's a good point. Because to go to Doctor Strange and Marvel, you know, they have their hands and they use it to cast magic and it's easier. But at the same time, there's somebody with an amputee who is able to use magic. It might be a little bit harder, but he can still do it. So you're right. I shouldn't say confirmation.
So this little weasel, Valda, hops off his horse and he is called a questioner. So he is somebody who is in the White Cloak army. White Cloak is a colloquial term for the army that is known as the Children of the Light. So they are a group of zealots that they find all dark friends and kill them to like an insane degree. So Valda's role as a questioner is to just essentially torture people to confirm and get confessions that they're dark friends. All Children of the Light slash White Cloaks, which because it's the same thing, believe that Aes Sedai are dark friends. So they immediately believe that they're all witches of the dark. Can't be trusted. Got to kill all of them.
I just think something like that is just so ridiculous back in the day. It's like, no matter, you could just torture the shit out of someone. They could be telling the truth and you're just going to keep torturing
them.
That
is a huge plot point in the books. Constantly. They are just, they say, if you're going to torture them long enough, they're going to say whatever you want them to say, you know? And that's why the questioners are so.
That's what I'm thinking. If that's me getting tortured over and over and I'm being truthful as shit, at some point it's like, okay, kill me. Yes, you're right.
Yes. You know?
Yep. That's kind of the role that they play.
That's so unfair.
But they do a good job of this scene of comparing Valda himself and the way he's kind of a little crazy to the man who's actually the leader of this little squad. His name is Geoffrem Bornhold. So we can just call him Bornhold at the moment.
He can like look in someone's eyes and tell if they're telling the truth or not.
No.
That is a wild assumption.
No. He says to Moraine, you should go to that city.
Oh, that guy.
Okay. Yes. He says you should go to the city and get that looked at by an Aes Sedai.
That line is a little wild. Because I don't think any White Cloak would recommend going to an Aes Sedai. Was a little bit of a weird line, but I don't know.
Help me out one more time. What is the questioner's name?
Aemon?
Let's just go with Valda.
I would just say Valda. His first name is spelled E-A-M-O-N, which is kind of like, is it Eamon? Is it Eamon?
Eamon.
I think people Valda. Will run with it a little bit, so I would just say Valda.
Okay. Just want to say Valda, incredible character so far.
Yep.
I don't like him. But I love his character. He looks so evil and complex. His actor, the way he portrays him, great so far, even though he's only been on the screen for like 7 minutes. Going back to the opening scene, you know, when he grabs the ring off of the one Aes Sedai bringing at the stakes, severed hand, adds to the collection. And Luke over here, he was like, yeah, I counted it. It's 7 rings. That ends up being, you know, very important going forward. To add on to this character, we know in this show already that colors kind of have meaning. So like within the Aes Sedai, the ones that chase down the men that channel, they have their own color. They're red. Moraine, she's rocking blue.
That was burned at the stake.
Yeah, which Michelle Alki noticed.
She was rocking yellow, right?
I believe she was rocking yellow. So colors mean things. And within the White Cloaks, it seemed that the guy, I'm sorry, help me out with his name, the one who recommended to go see
Bornhold.
Yeah, Borny. How did I forget Borny? So
I'm okay with Borny.
Borny's great.
Borny is rocking a gold shoulder gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
And the questioner and all of his followers are rocking silver. And to go back to the opening scene, they focus in on Valda.
It's basically Dave Talda.
Okay.
But with a V.
There's no way I can figure it out. Yeah.
Dave commented on that when I told him.
I've never seen a name like that close to Talda. And I was like, that's my name.
So Valda's goblet was like pure silver. They focused in on it. So like, I don't know what it means. It's a little division within the White Cloaks itself, a different faction. It's really cool. And I fucking love it.
The main takeaways from this scene are we get the re-emphasis about Moraine not lying, but telling a truth that you don't expect to hear. And then we also, in my opinion, is super important to know, is that Valda himself says to Bornhold as they're walking away that we questioners answer to a higher power than you guys. So just know that there's some tension going on within the White Cloaks themselves. And then again, Moraine proved here in the next scene with Egwene when they're talking that the truth you think you hear isn't always what you think. Like that's the workaround of how they don't always lie. They can never lie, but they don't always tell the truth.
Yeah. And that's another reason why people don't trust the Aes Sedai, because everyone for the most part knows about the three O's and they know they can't lie, but they know that they're kind of slimy in that way, that they dance around lying. Yeah.
Yes.
But I will say Aemon Valda does sneak into my top three most interesting characters.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. He has that slimy confidence when he's kind of interrogating Moraine, and it's pissing Lan off a lot. Yeah. He's like, oh, like, where are you from? And he's like,
my favorite possible quote besides eyes like embers. That is literally
where are you going? No.
Oh, okay, we'll bring that up again when we get there.
But it's when Moraine's like, he mentioned that he won't forget our faces today, but he's not the only one that's going to forget a face today.
And
like,
gang.
That was
so fucking badass.
That was tough. But I think it's Lan for me. Lan, Valda, and Tom Marilyn are my three. Like,
these are interesting.
Not favorites, but they're my, like, I'm keeping close tabs on these three.
That would be a wild top three.
Rosamund Pike is an amazing actress. We already know this from Gone Girl, but I mean, her differentiation in facial expressions between being Moraine, who is literally frowning half the time, it feels like, or just straight face, to, oh, I'm going to pretend that I'm a lady from the Fallen House, which, question in itself, what is that? I'm going to ask you later. But her just smiling when Valda is questioning her and all this other stuff, and it's like, oh, my wound. And like all this other stuff. Her smiling is so good.
That scene. Yeah.
She looked like she was actually very weak in that moment too. Like she looked sickly. Like, I mean, granted, yes, she was injured, blah, blah, blah. But I think she emphasized it a little bit more in that scene with her tone of voice. Like just the face. Yeah, I agree, Paul. It was a really good acting on her part.
All right. So we can transition away from the slimy white cloaks into one of my absolute favorite scenes. This is a scene where everyone who read the books was so excited for this scene to happen. And it doesn't happen in the same way, but I still think it was so good the way it was done. Mostly because the song now is stuck in my head of Sing of Manetherin, oh weep, weep, oh Manetherin.
Parents, the bass, yeah.
Yeah, dude, it's really good. They're so good together singing. So the words of the song reach Moraine, essentially, and she's like, whoa, I know that. So she tells them that Manetherin is actually a real thing, because Matt even has the quote, like, it's just a song. Who is Manetherin? Moraine tells them a story of that in the area where the Two Rivers is, and in the Mountains of the Mist, there used to be a city called Manetherin, which in the Old Tongue means mountain home. Very long story short, this is one of the first cities to emerge after the world was broken by the dragon. So it became essentially almost a keystone for building the new world in the aftermath. Then, after a period of relative peace, Trollocs came down again in what is known as the Trolloc War. So Trollocs descend on Manetherin, a small city, but a very strong army, which I just love this little fact that was a thorn in the side of the Dark One. Mm-hmm. I just like that a lot. So they fought the Trollocs for 10 whole days, thinking that they were going to get some aid, but they were betrayed by allies who promised them aid.
After 3 days.
Yes.
They said, we will help you if you survive 3 days. We will help mm-hmm. you. And they survived fucking 10. Yeah. So shout
12,
out.
12, right? It was 12. 13.
Yeah, it got past. Yeah, it got past that. Yeah.
So there's two key points, I think, that happen here is that, or actually even three. She mentions that the villagers even joined in on the battle. They left the city to go then fight on the front lines. And this was paralleled with people from the village of Emmonsfield fighting the Trollocs. They take down that Trolloc by themselves. They weren't all just going to hide. And the second thing, which is tied to that, the old blood. So this is kind of tying in that whole ancestry of you guys have this reputation that people from the Two Rivers are born of people from Manetherin, and the people from Manetherin were fucking badasses that didn't take shit. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing will be that kind of the tragic love story at the end of it, in that Queen Eldrine was so grief-stricken when her husband, who was King Aemon, died, that she basically blew up the whole fucking city and everything surrounding it.
Including the Trolloc army.
Yes, including the whole army. And then afterwards, the people found their way back to rework and live on the land because the old blood is strong and they don't fucking take shit. Mm-hmm. So that scene, that story feels very like exposition-y and almost out of place, but that lays such a foundation for the characters themselves and the reason why they are the way they are. And there's actually an animated short that Amazon put out that's based on this story.
Oh, that's hot.
So I don't know if they're available yet, but I would go to Amazon, to Prime, and I haven't found it yet. But they did put out a small short animated on this stuff. So I would definitely, if you're interested in it, go watch that.
Okay, a little bit of clarification. So Queen Aldrine was actually an enemy of Manetherus.
No, she was the queen of the city, but the king fell and the army fell. So instead of letting the Trollocs come into the city, and she was so like upset that she pulled in the One Power because she could channel.
Yes.
And she pulled in so much that she blew up everything.
Yeah, Hurricane of Fire, which is hot to hear. Yeah. So Blood Aemon, I'm sorry, the Blood of Aemon, which they sing in the song, King Aemon was...
is their ancestor.
Okay, I thought King Aemon was leading the enemies.
No. The enemy was the Trollocs.
Yes.
The Trolloc Wars, the humans, all the humans were good people.
Okay.
That's their blood. That's the old blood that they have been born from.
Gotcha. The fact that Queen Aldrine used more of the One Power than anyone else had is fucking nuts. I mean, she shriveled up and died, but the fact that she used it the most, I mean, that's amazing.
And then the other thing that happens before we start moving to important stuff, I mean, more important stuff, I should say, sorry.
Whoa, yeah, I was going to say, this might have been Kathleen's favorite scene.
Is totally favorite, just the scene with Perrin, who is again by himself at this point, and he's looking at the injury on his leg. And we have the wolf scene, right? The wolf comes up and licks his leg. And I think you guys both kind of had a thought on this, at least when we were live.
Perrin sneaks into the top three.
This is interesting. Yeah, guys.
An ever-changing top three.
Earlier I said that Perrin had the best storyline. How am I going to go back on that by not even putting
Give me what
top
you
three?
Think about that wolf scene, though. Because you both, I remember, were saying things out loud when we were watching it.
And my theory on the initial reaction, I thought it had something to do with him being a werewolf. Now, I don't know. I just kind of thought he's seen all these wolves. They're helping him out. Like, he's having weird visions of his girlfriend being dead and the wolf was fucking eating her stomach out in that one vision. Like, it was really crazy. So at first I thought a werewolf, but now I'm kind of thinking the show is more intricate than that. And now he's just on my watch list. I don't know what to expect.
Yeah, I could see this going a few different ways. It's so annoying because they're like, oh, like, who do you think the Dragon Reborn is? I'm like, I don't know. All four of them have like their own moments. You're like, oh, it's them.
He's really the doctor. Don't think it's Egwene. At this point in time, I'm really not thinking it's Egwene.
But like, I see this Perrin scene, and all right, the wolves are they bad? Are they good? Either way, they lick the wound that
they're friendly. That proves right there that they're friendly. The fact that they didn't just tear his leg off.
But it was also a Trolloc poison wound, and I don't know. I was like, yo, they're licking that wound that was made by evil. Like, are they evil themselves?
I am in the same boat as you, man. I'm like looking at this and I have no way to take it. The only thing that makes it interesting for me, though, is that I'm just kind of thinking that he is potentially, like, I don't think this is a good power to have. At the end of the day, I don't think this is a good power.
So whatever's going on with Perrin, you think is going to be a negative?
You think it's more of a curse?
I think it's more of a curse. Yeah. So I don't know. This is me just spinning. This is
you saying that with your legs like that is convincing.
Yeah. You look very intelligent.
You look very intelligent.
Like,
even though with those UGG slippers.
My leg is just crossed. My UGG slippers on. I'm wearing joggers.
You look so confidently intelligent.
You look like a podcaster.
We have to take a picture. But all right. And in the same breath, you're like, all right, like wolves, like their nature, the Aes Sedai used the power of nature. Like, dude, they could be good or bad. Like, I have no idea where this is going.
No.
All I know is that Perrin is on my top three watch list.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it.
Let me take us to the next major spot, then you take it away for us, because this is another transitional couple scenes here. That night, after the Perrin goes back, they're all sleeping by the campfire. Of course, Lan's going to be the one on watch. And then I think, Egwene
that wakes up
She
hears the whispers in the wind. And I'm like, she's the Dragon Reborn. Dude, it's they all have their moments. It's crazy.
Well, out on Egwene being Dragon Reborn. But essentially, what's happening is the Fade and the Trollocs finally caught up from the ferry scene, and they start chasing the whole squad. Squad rallies. Moraine can't walk. She's basically in dire straits now. Lan throws Moraine up to Perrin, says, hold her. We got to fucking bounce right now. They eventually get to a border of an area where they're about to get caught by the Trolloc army. And then everybody just stops, including the horses, who won't move forward. And we find out the camera pans, you see that the Trolloc army is just, there's like an invisible barrier that the Trolloc army won't cross. Lan leads him in, says the Trollocs will not follow us in here. And what we see is this, it's just like a, it's a perfect fantasy city, right? It's just epically big. It's over the top, just this beautifully broken down city that just seems to be abandoned. And our squad is walking through this and there seems to be no life at all. No plants. They say no bugs, no people, no noise.
Lan then leads them into this large abandoned building, sets them up and gives them this background that's really funny because he talks about how the city used to be called Arathal and it was very powerful, but they were actually one of the cities, or it might actually even be the city that turned their back on Manetherin only to be devoured by its own evil. So they kind of shut their own walls off to everyone else in the world during the Trolloc Wars to try to protect themselves. But in the end, by locking themselves in with everyone else, the paranoia and the evil inside the walls actually was the downfall of the city. But Matt also just has a great line here where he's like, well, first of all, that's the most words you've said today and maybe ever.
That was great.
And second, like, why did you bring us here?
That was like one of the moments where I was like, fuck, man, I really like your actor. And now you're not going to be in season two.
And then to even further add to how likable his actor is, at least as Matt, what happens right after this is Matt and Perrin have that like good scene where Matt kind of is consoling him about his wife, gives him the knife that she made. And that to me was like a beautiful scene, especially when I watch it for the second time. I'm like, wow, they're really hammering home how boys these boys are, you know, they're homies.
It's just annoying because if they're homies, why doesn't Perrin, I guess he's ashamed, why doesn't he tell them the truth about Layla and why he can't live with himself? They obviously,
it's believable.
I know, it's just frustrating. But
so hard.
What does that even do though?
To admit you say that, to yourself and others, yeah, that
to
you,
explain to why you are like you are right now, like I, depressed.
I think the big thing is admitting it, almost saying it out loud. Yeah, it's such a big step.
I believe that it's hard.
Yeah,
but like, come on, like. They made a point earlier, Egwene earlier in the episode said, like, all these Trolloc came in, they killed Nynaeve. They killed Nynaeve. They killed Layla. And Perrin just like stood there, stone faced, and like twitched real quick. It's like,
it's not something that has to be addressed right now, I think. I think the story itself will address it later in probably a more dire situation, let's be honest. Like when they really need him, it's going to affect him more. But I think right now, it's, of course, it can be, he's not acting that. He's not acting that out of the ordinary.
Yeah, I agree, but I'm like, dude, tell them they're your best friends you're traveling
with. But I agree. There's always that thing. It's like, you just got to be open with your friends at this point in time.
This scene made me love Matt. I thought
this point in time?
That's my catchphrase, apparently.
This is a great Matt scene. I just love the line. It's also interesting that it's a good way to work Layla into the squad a little too, because she shows that she knows Matt too, where she says that, you know, I'm giving you this dagger. It's probably going to be used as a tool more than anything else. But if you get into trouble, like, keep it sharp. And she knew that he would probably be the one to get everyone else in trouble because that's just how Matt is. And I think that's such a nice little way at the end to connect Matt and Perrin too, because that's like a nice callback to Layla. And Matt's trying to be a nice guy, but that's just so goddamn sure.
I think we did in the last episode, I think it's time for a speed run of the whole act three part. And then we just talk about our favorites, because this is just, you just got to watch it to know.
Yeah, I mean, this shit happens pretty quickly. So everyone falls asleep and Matt wakes up to whispers. He's kind of hearing voices a little bit. So he, like every smart person in every horror movie or TV show you've ever watched, wanders into the abandoned city alone and is investigating these voices a little bit. Then he sees a shadow of a person, follows the person like everyone else would, finds a dagger, cool dagger. Next thing you know, black mist covering the entire city. Horse swallowed, turned to ashes. Team split up. We have Matt and Rand, Egwene and Perrin. So those two squads go their separate ways. Lan and Moraine are a little late on the uptake because Moraine is on the verge of death. Rand and Matt run, have to break down a door. They have to break down a gate. They jump out of the city into the water. Egwene and Perrin try to get high. So they run up the walls, jump off the walls into the water. Dead. And Lan and Moraine,
what do they get high with, though?
Shut up.
Their feet. And Lan and Moraine ride out of Shadar Logoth to, I guess, relative safety.
And the first sticking point for me here, like something that just is so awesome, I don't know why, and maybe you guys tell me differently, but as the second shit's starting to go down, Moraine wakes up and is in Lan's arms, and she goes, "Where are we?" Lan doesn't say anything. She goes, "You killed us all." Like, the, just the epicness of that, because they did argue about this earlier in the episode about not going to this city because it's so cursed, but it was the only way that Lan could protect the squad from the Trolloc army. So honestly, I see it from both perspectives, but just like the weight behind Moraine waking up and 3 seconds later knowing the gravity of the situation was just so fucking cool to me. And that was my favorite part, this whole Shadar Logith scene.
I just like the idea of having some literal disease-looking thing just spreading across the city, and whatever is alive, it will just disintegrate. That is so terrifying to me. And the fact that at first I thought it was only like a secluded amount of like space, I guess you want to call it, that would be able to
do that, like a blob,
exactly. But when it's, I think it's
Egwene and Perrin.
Egwene and Perrin are on top of the castle. Yeah, when they get high, and you see it overrunning the entire city, that's when you're like, holy fucking shit. Like, this isn't something that's meant to be escaped from. Like, this is going to murder anything that's alive in the city.
Dude, talk about cutting it close. They jumped literally right as the mold, the black mold, was getting to their feet. Like,
are we talking broken legs here?
Yeah.
So,
should have broken their legs in that fall.
Of course, like, after they all get split up into their three different groups, we have Lan and Moraine by themselves. Lan's just holding a sick Moraine and is pretty lost at what to do. And at this point, we have a blade put to his neck. And this is the closing statement of the final episode. You turn and you see a fucking disheveled Nynaeve holding the blade right to his throat. Says, "If you don't take me to them right now, I'll slit your throat."
I mean, exactly what I said in the instant reaction is the fact that she was able to sneakily just get behind Lan and just hold a knife to his throat is just already proves that she is so sneaky.
That
gives her such a power increase in my mind. Like, before that, okay, she was taking on a Trolloc a little bit with her and Egwene. Sure, we'll give her credit. But right here is the moment for me where it's like, damn, give this fucking girl some respect.
That's funny you say that, because my first thought was the opposite. I was like, damn, Lan, you really dropped the ball here. I was like, you're supposed to be like, you know, the warder. Like, I understand. My thought process was, you know, like, he's looking down at an unconscious Moraine right now. He's preoccupied. He's trying to save her. You know, he's probably not on as high alert. But to your point, Nynaeve is a badass.
And we get into more of the stealthiness in the next episode. Yeah. But Nynaeve definitely has some like shadowy aspect to her.
I was so happy when she appeared on screen, because I was like, I knew it. It wasn't dead.
Yeah.
You don't show me their death on screen, I don't trust. So I do want to go back a little bit, just real quick. The fact that Matt woke up and two, you know, whispers. Was this more of the dark whispers?
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Yeah, it has to be. And to continue on, when he does go around the corner, like turn the street, he sees the shadow go into a room. I was thinking, is that a physical being actually leading him the way? Or is that somebody giving him visions? Like, look, we already know the madness can make you see things that you don't think are there. So, like, does madness have Matt, or was there actual being in there leading him there? And then the other thing, I assume that whatever the black mold was got released as soon as he opens the chest and unsheathes the golden knife, because it had an ember on it, or it had a ruby on it that looked like, you know, the ember eyes of the evil one a little bit. I might be stretching there, but I mean, as soon as he opens it, all fucking shit hits the fan. So, I assume that the evil that took everyone over in the first place in that town was somehow sealed in there. And then this is not really a complaint, but like, wouldn't the Trollocs, they wouldn't go in? Wouldn't they just surround the area?
It's a huge city.
It is really big.
Huge.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
You remember when you saw Rand? He was looking out. Oh, like Assassin's Creed. Like, it was like a full on fucking. Even if they had a full army, like, you couldn't surround.
He couldn't even see the other side.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Lan does ride out the same way they went in, but it's kind of a narrative choice, I will say. I guess is like a nice way to say that. But to build off of the idea of the whispers and everything, when Matt opens the box and picks up the dagger, the whispers stop. All of the noise in the background stops.
So it might not have been unsheathing. It might have been opening the chest.
I'm just saying. I'm not speculating. I'm just saying. that when he picks it up, the whispers do end.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.